From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, from Hitler to the hippie counterculture, we look at the history of the Volkswagen Beetle with Phil Patton, author of Bug, The Strange Mutations of the World's Most Famous Automobile. Also singer and songwriter Linda Thompson. In the 70s and early 80s, she made a series of now classic recordings with her then-husband Richard Thompson. But in the late 80s, she stopped performing because of a vocal problem. Now she's making a comeback with a new CD. We'll also be joined by her son Teddy Thompson, who plays and sings on it and co-wrote many of the songs. And TV critic David Bianculli previews the new TV season. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Palestinians called for a general strike in the West Bank and Gaza Strip today to protest the Israeli siege of Yasser Arafat's Ramallah compound. The Palestinian leader refused an Israeli demand for a list of those inside the compound with him. NPR's Peter Kenyon reports.
Some Palestinian stores were shut and schools closed early, and thousands marched in Gaza in support of Arafat, who only a week ago was the subject of growing criticism among his people. Palestinian negotiator Sy Barakat met with Arafat at the battered compound and said Arafat decided it was none of Israel's business who else was in the compound. Israel says 50 wanted Palestinians are holed up there. Five Palestinians were shot and killed yesterday, including a 14-year-old boy assisting international peace activists in Nablus. British activists said the boy was not throwing stones and there was no discernible reason for the shooting. The army said it was investigating the allegation. Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon said at some point the military would have to move in on Hamas leaders in the Gaza Strip. Peter Kenyon, NPR News, Jerusalem.
Attorney General John Ashcroft has resumed his effort to stop Oregon from permitting physician-assisted suicide. Ashcroft filed an appeal seeking to prevent Oregon doctors from prescribing lethal doses of medication for terminally ill patients. Ashcroft lost a federal court case in April after he argued that assisted suicide is not a legitimate medical practice, despite the Oregon state law that permits it. Oregon's Death with Dignity Act was twice approved by Oregon voters. Iraq is asking for other countries to oppose a tough new United Nations resolution concerning Baghdad's disarmament. The United States and Britain are pushing for a resolution threatening military action if Iraq fails to comply with UN weapons inspections. NPR's Kate Seeley has more from Kuwait City.
Al-Thawra newspaper, the mouthpiece of the ruling Ba'ath Party, called American attempts to issue a new UN resolution wicked. It appealed to the international community to reject U.S. efforts. There is no need or justification to adopt a new resolution, and the overwhelming majority of the world's countries know this, added the paper. Last week, Iraq offered to readmit UN arms inspectors in accordance with UN resolutions, but the U.S. and Great Britain are now trying to pass a tough new Security Council resolution to ensure Baghdad's disarmament. Yesterday, Iraq's Vice President, Taha Yassin Ramadan, accused the U.S. of wanting to use the new resolution as a cover for launching an attack on Iraq. Kate Seeley, NPR News, Kuwait City.
In stocks today, the Dow Jones Industrials lost 114 points, or 1.4%, to close at 7,872 in heavy trading. The Nasdaq lost 36 points, or 3%, to close at 1,184. This is NPR News. German Chancellor Gerhard Schroeder said today that he'll continue to oppose a U.S. attack on Iraq. Schroeder spoke just a day after winning re-election, in part because of his opposition to any unilateral American military action against Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein. Schroeder did take a step toward repairing relations with the Bush administration when he told reporters that he will not reappoint the justice minister who compared President Bush with Adolf Hitler. So far, the Bush administration has not congratulated Schroeder on his re-election. Vice President Dick Cheney is on the campaign trail in Kansas, where Republicans are hoping to reclaim a congressional seat. Matt Hackworth reports from member station KCUR in Kansas City.
Moderate Republicans crossed party lines 4 years ago to elect Democrat Dennis Moore to the 3rd Congressional District seat. Now, Moore faces a moderate opponent in November's election, a race contentious enough to bring in the vice president to fundraise for Republican challenger Adam Taft. But Moore says he'll keep the moderate Republicans who elected into office as supporters.
I think, again, people know me, and I think if people feel comfortable with me and the job that I've done, they'll vote for me, irrespective of party politics.
Besides the vice president's visit, Republicans are hoping Adam Taft's background as a Navy fighter pilot will appeal to the moderates, especially as the United States prepares for a possible war in Iraq. For NPR News, I'm Matt Hackworth in Kansas City.
People on the Gulf Coast of Texas are bracing for a potential hurricane that could strike within the next day or two. Weather forecasters fear that Tropical Storm Isidore, which was downgraded from a hurricane, could regain speed as it passes over the Gulf. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Aircast Foundation, working to support medicine and science through the funding of orthopedic research. On the web at aircastfoundation.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The Volkswagen Beetle may have the strangest history of any car. It was designed in response to Adolf Hitler's demand for an affordable car for the German people. 30 years later, after it caught on in the U.S., the Beetle became the affordable car of the hippie counterculture. By the 80s, the VW Bug had been overtaken by compact Japanese cars, but the Beetle's design was so popular it was revived in the 90s with a new retro model that came in candy-colored designs. My guest, Phil Patton, is the author of the new book, Bug, The Strange Mutations of the World's Most Famous Automobile. He writes regularly for the New York Times Design Notebook, Public Eye, and Automotive columns. He was a consulting curator for the Museum of Modern Art's 1999 exhibition on automobiles for the new century. I asked Patton about Hitler's connection to the Beetle.
Hitler really was the man who made the Volkswagen happen. The idea of a people's car had been around in Germany for many years, and there were advocates for it. But the very first thing Hitler did after coming to power as chancellor in January of 1933 was to declare he was going to help the automobile industry build highways and build a car for the masses. This, of course, was quite popular, and the vision of American prosperity danced in the minds of Germans, and it was something he wanted to exploit.
Does Volkswagen translate from people's car?
Volkswagen literally means people's car, and it was really a generic name before it became a trademark. There had been talk of a people's car in Germany back in the 20s, and there were even models of cars from other manufacturers called people's cars or Volkswagen, well before the actual Nazi model appeared.
Why was building cars and building roads so important for Hitler's plan?
It's important to remember that Hitler's grasp on power was a bit tenuous when he first became chancellor. And with unemployment high, building highways was an excellent way to create jobs. And helping the automobile industry was, in a modern industrial economy, a way to pump up the economy. In fact, a lot of economists believe that it did more to restore the German economy than rearmament actually did. So he was fairly shrewd in both creating economic stimulus and propaganda appeal.
Now, was the development of cars and highways linked in Hitler's mind to militarization?
William Shirer and other historians have depicted the Volkswagen as pretty much just a propaganda ploy, but it really was quite closely woven into Hitler's own vision. He saw the Autobahns extending into the conquered territories in the East, and he even measured out the map of these conquered territories according to how far a Volkswagen could go in a day. He ordered that villages be built for the new German farmers he was going to install there, and there would be a town with an inn, a Volkswagen's drive apart from each of the other towns.
Now, Hitler asked Porsche to design the car. I always thought that Porsche was the founder of the Porsche and never associated him with designing the humble VW Bug.
Well, it's funny. Ferdinand Porsche was a major public figure in Europe. He was a hero engineer who had even worked for the Kaiser in the First World War. And he was well known, having worked designing racing cars and other cars for Mercedes and other companies. And he had been pushing a people's car, too. like Hitler, he was a guy from the provinces, and he had a notion of bringing a fairly inexpensive, good car back to the sort of rural folk from whom he sprang. So they had an interesting relationship. Porsche didn't have much interest in ideology, but he had a kind of almost avuncular relationship with Hitler, and the two of them got along in a very strange and weird way.
How did the bug get its shape?
The bug got its shape from some of the ideas about streamlining of the period. The airflow in other cars had been appearing. As speeds got higher, the engineers were looking to reduce drag. But Hitler was very interested in specifically getting involved. He fancied himself an automotive expert, and he instructed Porsche to look to nature for the shapes of streamlining, and specifically told him, look to the beetle, lending this nickname almost immediately. And Hitler made also, it appears, a number of drawings suggesting the shape, and you can be sure that Dr. Porsche hastened to round the front in just the manner that Hitler had suggested.
While the VW bug was being built, Hitler gave it a different name. He called it the KDF wagon. What does that name mean? What was the significance of that name?
Hitler wanted the car called the Strength Through Joy wagon. That was the organization, Strength Through Joy, a propaganda organization that organized recreational activities for workers to boost their morale. And one of the things that they had were savings plans. You could save for a ski vacation or a cruise. Finally, it was hit upon that workers could save a few marks each week and buy the car in this manner.
But you say even when it was officially being called the KDF wagon, the logo that was coming off of the assembly line and being put on the car was the VW logo. How did that happen?
There was a KDF logo, which was partly derived from the swastika, but there was a lot of public skepticism toward all the Nazi propaganda, and most people really referred to it still as the Volkswagen. The name had simply been established for so long.
Toward the end of World War II, slave labor was used at the VW production plant. And you say the people from occupied countries in Eastern Europe and in Europe were kind of enslaved to work in this plant. People were taken out of Auschwitz to work in the plant. Describe what you know of what working conditions were like at that point in time at the VW plant in Germany.
Slave labor of all types was used, including, first of all, Soviet prisoners of war. Prisoners of war, of course, are not supposed to be impressed into labor under the Geneva Convention, but they were. People who were pulled out of occupied France as political opponents, people who were brought from Poland and other conquered territories in the East, including women, and at one point skilled Jewish metal workers brought from concentration camps. And absurdly, each of these different types of laborer was given a different food ration, different uniform, different privileges within the plant, where a variety of wartime activities were going on in addition to simply building military vehicles. Bombs, artillery shells, all sorts of things were built in this vast factory that had been planned to turn out millions of cars.
Did VW ever offer any public apology for using slave labor and people from the concentration camps?
VW was in the 1990s one of the most forward of the German companies, and most major German companies had used the slave labor in trying to come to terms with this under their CEO, Karl Hahn. Hahn commissioned an 800-page book by the eminent German historian Hans Mommsen and a team of historians working for him to come to a full accounting of those years. And what is amazing is how much documentation there was, both office papers, photographs, things that survived. Volkswagen also established a fund to compensate surviving slave laborers well before there was a national fund established by the German government. And then they began to turn their back a little bit when Ferdinand Piëch became CEO. Piëch's father had been the head of the factory during the war. Piëch's grandfather was Ferdinand Porsche, and he felt that that in many ways the accounting of the slave labor years, the whole Nazi experience, had been aimed at embarrassing him, and he refused to have the book translated into other languages.
My guest is Phil Patton, author of the new book Bug, The Strange Mutations of the World's Most Famous Automobile. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about the history of the Volkswagen Beetle. My guest, Phil Patton, is the author of the new book, Bug, The Strange Mutations of the World's Most Famous Automobile. When the Volkswagen was exported to the United States, the image of the car, I think, really started to change. For a lot of Jewish people in the United States, it was a car associated with the Nazis, and they didn't want to go near it. And I'm sure a lot of other Americans had similar misgivings about this car. What was done to change the image of the Volkswagen Beetle from Hitler's car to a fun, cheap, small car that Americans would enjoy?
Well, a few GIs had brought Volkswagens back from Europe, and there were a few imported. But it really took a growing sense of the Beetle as a product of West Germany, not of greater Hitler Germany, and also an ad campaign by the late 1950s, ironically, as with so many things in the Beetle story, by a Jewish ad agency. These were probably the most famous ads of the century, and the campaign was voted the best ad campaign in a number of century-end surveys. The Think Small ads, the Lemon ads, which talked about the single strip of chrome disqualifying a Volkswagen from being shipped over, all these turned on the German image for high technology, because frightening as they were in a military way, we knew their technology was good. We knew their rocket scientists were helping us put satellites in orbit in the late 50s. And also, there was a sense that the ad agency moved to Americanize the car. That was their initial goal. And they did that by latching on to an existing set of American values. Detroit was advertising its cars on the basis of such American values as flash and size and power and speed. But the ad agency for Volkswagen went back to American virtues such as frugality, economy, the characteristics of the Model T or the covered wagon. And probably the best advertisement that summed this up was the one they did around the time of the moon landing that showed the lunar lander, which was itself called Bug, with the line, "It's ugly, but it gets you there." And all those American virtues of can-do, do-it-yourself, plainness were soon to be reflected in the Beetle.
The Beetle caught on for a lot of young college people, and then it became a really big car in the hippie counterculture of the 60s. What do you think accounts for that? Do you think it's because it was cheap, or do you think that there was something else at work there?
Part of the Beetle's appeal was first in academic towns, and I grew up in a college town where I remember seeing Beetles along with the odd Italian and British sports car. But it was not the people who bought the people's car in the United States, not the workers and farmers, but intellectuals and people who appreciated it by contrast with the big chrome tail fin Detroit vehicles. And it was very much a kind of reverse snobism to make a statement with that kind of vehicle. Later, as the 60s went on, there was a baby boom in progress. A lot of teenagers had a Beetle as their first car because it was an economical vehicle to add to the family garage.
I remember in the 60s, there were a lot of Jewish families in which buying a Volkswagen was a very controversial act. You know, the newly adult kid wanted a Volkswagen because it was a cheap car and it was, you know, a kind of hip car to have. And the parents often felt like you shouldn't give them your money because this was a car associated with Hitler and the Nazis. How could you buy it? Do you remember those debates?
I remember those debates not only about Volkswagen, and they're completely understandable, but about Mercedes. And that was the feeling of people like George Lois, who worked at the ad agency producing the Volkswagen ads. There was a great deal of ambivalence on the part of the ad agency about working with a car that he said still reminded you of the ovens. You know, how would they deal with that issue?
Do you think that link between Volkswagen and Hitler still exists in the minds of many American consumers? Do you think that that's that there are many people now who would not buy that car because of its roots in the Reich?
What surprises me, particularly with the new Beetle and particularly with people in their 20s and younger, is in many cases an absence of awareness even of the old Beetle. It's something they see in movies, and it's a distant memory, but they don't associate it. They don't even associate the new Beetle so much with the old Beetle, and they have very little awareness of the whole history of the car, its birth in the Third Reich. And really the whole story of the Beetle has been this twist of ironies, a tragicomic moving in and out of the dark sides into the bright sides of culture. How you go from Himmler to Herbie, how you end up being a plush toy sold in the Disney Mall store after starting out as a detailed model given to Adolf Hitler on his birthday. It's just one of those very strange crystals that takes all of our history of the last century and throws it into many fascinating lights.
Well, Phil Patton, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks, Terry. This was fun.
Phil Patton is the author of the new book, Bug, The Strange Mutations of the World's Most Famous Automobile. After a slow summer, it's a busy time for TV. The Emmy Awards were held last night. The fall TV season begins officially today. And TV critic David Bianculli says they both have to do with the same thing, broadcast versus cable TV.
At the Emmys last night, the final two awards made it sound like business as usual for the big broadcast networks. NBC won Best Drama for The West Wing and Best Comedy for Friends. And earlier in the night, CBS won three major acting awards for Everybody Loves Raymond, and Fox picked up the major writing awards for 24 in drama and The Bernie Mac Show in comedy. But you take those few shows out of the equation for a second, and what are the broadcast networks left with? Almost nothing. Cable went home with almost every award for telemovies and miniseries, with HBO's Band of Brothers and The Gathering Storm winning particularly big. And the biggest win of all, a stunning upset, came when Michael Chiklis won the Best Dramatic Series Actor Emmy for his work as a rogue cop on The Shield. That's a series on FX, a cable network about as low on the radar as you can go. And speaking of taking something out of the equation, one of the reasons Chiklis may have won is that another cable series, HBO's The Sopranos, wasn't eligible this year. Last year, James Gandolfini won the Best Actor category, just as Edie Falco won Best Actress. Next year, they'll be back, and it'll be a tougher contest, especially for broadcast TV. This season, broadcast TV isn't doing much to call attention to itself. The 2002 fall TV season starts today, yet all the thunder, good and bad, seems to be taken already. The one TV show everyone is talking about right now is The Sopranos, which returned finally 2 weeks ago. It's on cable. The best new show of the season started this summer. Monk, starring Tony Shalhoub, is a brilliant detective with obsessive-compulsive disorder. It's on cable, too, on USA Network. Both of these shows were developed for, then rejected by, broadcast networks, The Sopranos by Fox and Monk by ABC. For Fox, it was the one that got away, but that show would have been a completely different animal on broadcast TV. But Monk is a classic detective series, and ABC has admitted its mistake. It picked up reruns of Monk, showing episodes after USA Network did, and they ended up landing in the top 20. Starting this Thursday, Monk reruns will be part of ABC's fall lineup. And this series, which came from cable, is better than any of the more than 30 new shows this fall. Here's a taste of Monk, with Tony Shalhoub as the unusually impaired detective and Biddy Schramm as his very patient assistant. They've been called in to advise at a crime scene.
The stove.
Over here. It's in the kitchen.
No, I mean my stove. I think I left it on.
It's okay. I checked it as we were leaving.
Are you sure? Did you turn the knob?
Yeah.
The little knob, though.
I turned all the knobs. The stove was off, Adrian.
Excuse me, sir. We believe it was a burglary gone sour. She walked in, she surprised him, he panicked, he grabbed a knife from the kitchen,
No. This was no burglary.
It wasn't.
He tried to make it look like one, but this guy was cold as ice. He wore slippers to avoid leaving shoe prints. Not something your neighborhood crackhead is prone to do.
Adrian.
He was in here. He was waiting.
Waiting for what?
You know, for her. He was here at least an hour. He was smoking. You can still smell it on the curtains. Menthols, Salem's.
As for the other new shows this season, there are a few worth sampling at least once. There's Firefly on Fox, the new series from Buffy the Vampire Slayer's Joss Whedon. And two ABC shows, Push Nevada, a kind of warmed-over Twin Peaks, and Life with Bonnie, a new sitcom starring Bonnie Hunt. And The Twilight Zone, a solid UPN remake of the classic Rod Serling series. And finally, there's Boomtown on NBC, a new cop drama told from many different points of view. But there's not one new show, except for Monk, that I truly love. On broadcast TV this season, the real excitement isn't coming from the new shows popping up, but from the great ones coming back. Alias on ABC, 24 on Fox, Buffy on UPN. Give me those three shows every week, and I'm not complaining. Well, not much.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Bantam Books, publisher of And Justice There Is None, a Kincaid and James detective novel by Deborah Crombie, author of A Finer End. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Singer-songwriter Linda Thompson is making a comeback after years of being unable to sing because of a vocal problem. Coming up, we'll meet her and her son, Teddy Thompson, who performs with Linda on her new CD and co-wrote many of the songs.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, singer and songwriter Linda Thompson, made a series of recordings that are now considered classics, albums like Pour Down Like Silver and Shoot Out the Lights. They were collaborations with her then-husband, singer-songwriter and guitarist Richard Thompson. Her dark voice seemed to perfectly suit his brooding songs. The Thompsons married in 1972, the year he left the British folk rock group Fairport Convention, which he had co-founded. Their marriage fell apart 10 years later. Linda recorded a solo album in 1985, but then gave up performing because of a vocal problem that made it impossible for her to sing. Now, able to perform again, she's making a comeback with a new CD called Fashionably Late. Also with us is her son Teddy Thompson. He collaborated on the new CD, playing guitar, singing, and co-writing many of the songs, including the opening track, Dear Mary. That track is a family or ex-family affair, with Richard Thompson adding his guitar and backup vocals. Let's hear it.
Oh, Mary, you may have to run. You may have to be on your way. Consider the things that you've done. Oh, Mary, you may have to run. Remember your tales and your lies. They'll come back to haunt you one day. And all of the boys you may cry. I remember your tales and your lies.
Linda Thompson, Teddy Thompson, welcome to Fresh Air. Linda, you basically stopped singing in, what, around 1988?
About then, yeah.
And you were diagnosed with something that you've called hysterical dysphonia. What was the diagnosis they gave you?
Well, it was a diagnosis actually from a shrink, you know, rather than a medical man. And that was his diagnosis. I've always thought it was more physical or neurological than psychological, because I don't have to be nervous or unhappy or anything for it to happen. I mean, I can be talking to the greengrocer, you know, and it's so... I don't know. I mean, I'd be overjoyed if it was, you know, they could take a bit of your brain out that didn't work or something, but...
I don't think they can do that.
No, that's unfortunate. But, you know, maybe they could do something. Who knows? You know, it would be...
You expected to never perform again, but you're performing now. You have a new record out. What changed?
A guy, an American guy called David Thomas from Cleveland, who works with a group called Per Ubu, asked me to do some gigs with him. And I said no, but he insisted, so I sort of did it. And he's a very avant-garde musician, you know, very atonal stuff, which is much easier for me to do, in fact. And, you know, it seemed to work all right. And then Teddy and I wrote some songs together, and I decided to make a record.
Teddy, I want to ask you, you've recorded and performed with your father. You have your own record as well, your father, Richard Thompson. Now you're performing and recording with your mother as well. How did you feel about being on your mother's CD and working with her?
On it, I was that CD.
I should mention you co-wrote a lot of the songs on it.
Yeah, it was. I mean, it was. It wasn't as if I came in and you know, for a day and did something on my mom's record. It was a long, you know, process that we did together. You know, a lot of writing together and stuff. So it was very collaborative. It wasn't like a guest spot. You know, it was. Years of my life.
Well, during most of your life, your mother wasn't performing. So do you feel like you've seen a different side of her now?
The ugly side.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it's like, it's, you know, when parents have to become people, I suppose, at some point, you know, you have to see them as something else other than your parents and see them doing a job. And, you haven't had a job for about 25 years.
Been lying in a darkened room for 17 years.
So perhaps this is sort of a belated version of that.
Linda, why did you want Teddy to work with you on the CD?
He was cheap, basically. I mean, he's very, very good. And I just like working with family. You know, there's a wonderful dynamic between voices, you know, when you're related. Yeah, I think. I just like working. I like being with my kids more than I like being with anybody else. So it was a pleasure for me to work with Teddy and with Cammy, my youngest daughter.
What's the process when you're writing together?
It varies. I mean,
involves a lot of faxing.
Yes,
that's right. Because you're Teddy. You're in New York, and Linda, you're in England.
Yeah, but the first one, I think Teddy gave me the tune, and then I did some lyrics. And sometimes we do it the other way around. I'll give him some lyrics, and he'll do a tune. But you know, so we play them down the phone. Or I mean, I'm in New York a lot, so you know, we get to collaborate in person as well.
My guests are singer-songwriter Linda Thompson and her son, singer-songwriter and guitarist Teddy Thompson. Let's hear a track from Linda's new CD, Fashionably Late. This is Ivana Darling.
Do you remember? He can remember you. Ivana Darling, doesn't that make you blue? Living here like you do, doesn't that make you love a little too, girl? He's in love with you, Ivana. So in love with you.
That's Linda Thompson and Teddy Thompson from Linda's new CD, Fashionably Late. It's her first new recording since 1985. She's making a comeback after a long period during which vocal problems prevented her from performing. Linda, I'd like to hear a little bit about your life. You were born in London, grew up also in Glasgow.
Yep.
Your mother was a vaudevillian?
Yes, she was, for a very brief period of time. She was a Vera Love speciality dancer.
What kind of, does that mean speciality? Does that mean striptease?
Yeah, it does sound like that, doesn't it? No, but actually it wasn't. It wasn't striptease. She had an act with a friend of hers called Gaby Laird, and they just sort of sang and danced and wore. I've got these pictures of them wearing these funny little costumes. I don't think it lasted for very long, but you know, it's a nice story. I love vaudeville and music hall. It's so it's in sort of in my blood.
So did your mother encourage you to sing and dance when you were a kid?
Yeah, a little too much, I think. Yes.
What would she want you to do?
Well, you know, we lived in a council estate. You know, what would be projects, I guess, here. Mm-hmm. And you know, to be a singer or a dancer or a boxer or something, that was a way out. So, yeah, I think they were very keen for my brother and I to, you know, to have a, you know, better life than they did and stuff, you know.
So what were your specialty numbers as a child?
Oh, what were my specialty numbers as a child? Tammy. I used to sing Tammy, the Debbie Reynolds song, a perfectly execrable song, but I liked it at the time. I can't remember what else. My father used to sing Jealousy, which was this is a very ambitious tune, Jealousy, so that was very clever of him. My mother didn't sing anything because she couldn't sing.
Now, I understand you also recorded commercial jingles for a while?
Yeah, I did, with Manfred Mann. I did a lot of those in the, I can't remember if it was the 60s or 70s, you know, sometime when I was young. And that was very lucrative. I think that was the most lucrative thing I ever did.
Manfred Mann had the hit Doo-Wah Diddy.
Yeah, he had a lot of hits, but yeah, that was one of them. And
So you and he did commercial jingles. Do you remember what they were for?
Yeah, you know, for yogurt and for flour and things. And in those days, now you can use snippets of existing songs. But in those days, PRS didn't let you do that. So you actually had to write the jingle, which was incredibly lucrative.
So did you write the jingles yourself?
Well, you know, I co-wrote some of them, with him. I don't remember him. I don't actually remember getting much money for that. But but it was you could make a lot of money doing jingles.
What do I need to do to get you to sing one of those jingles?
I'll sing you one. Okay. Ski, the full of fitness food, good for everyone, da-da-da-da-da-da. See what absolute crap that was?
And what was it for, ski?
Ski was a yogurt. Yogurt,
oh,
you call it.
Uh-huh.
And the other one was, flower so fine, it flows and it flows.
What did your folk music friends think of you recording commercial jingles?
Oh, I used to watch the television and with them and say, can you imagine anybody stooping that low to sing that stuff? I just pretended it wasn't me.
But they knew it was you?
No.
They didn't know it was you?
No.
You hid it from them?
No. His dad stopped me doing it. He said, you can't do things like that. It's disgusting. And I, like a fool, I did. I stopped.
My guests are Linda Thompson and her son Teddy Thompson, who collaborated on her new CD. It's called Fashionably Late. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Linda Thompson. After being unable to perform for over a decade because of a vocal problem, she's now making a comeback with her new CD, Fashionably Late. Also with us is her son, Teddy Thompson, who collaborated on Linda's new CD, playing guitar, singing harmony, and co-writing many of the songs. You sang for several years with Richard Thompson.
I did.
Who you were married to for most of the time, or yes, all of the time that you performed together.
Almost all of the time.
How did it change your sense of yourself as a singer and what direction you wanted to head in when you teamed up with him?
I don't know. I mean, the material got better. That's, you know,
he writes great songs.
He writes great songs. So, you know, I stopped doing trad stuff although we did do some traditional stuff. The material got better. And I think at first I was quite insouciant about it.
Did the doctors of the songs that he was writing and you were singing speak to you?
Yeah. Yes, indeed. Yeah, I like sad songs make me happy. I like sad songs. That's what you said, isn't it?
Dark songs.
Yeah, no, I've always liked dark songs, yeah.
And speaking with Linda Thompson, let's listen to a recording from the 70s featuring Linda and Richard Thompson. This is Dimming of the Day.
This old house is falling down around my ears. I'm drowning.
That's Richard and Linda Thompson. My guest is Linda Thompson, and she has a new CD, which is called Fashionably Late. You know, we were talking a little bit about what it's like to be married to the person who you're performing with. You were recording and performing together as the marriage was breaking up, and even, I think, shortly after the marriage broke up. And that sounds like it must have been quite a trying,
quite a trying period,
but with great music.
Yeah, I mean, it was trying. I mean, when we did Shoot Out the Lights, the marriage was breaking up. But, you know, I didn't know, which sounds silly, but the wife is always the last to know. And also I was pregnant, you know, and you're, when you're pregnant, you're, I think your intellect kind of descends into your womb. You know, you sort of think about the baby. So, you know, I didn't know anything was going on, except, you know, maybe subliminally I did, but I didn't, you know, nothing was voiced. But after the record came out and we toured, then, you know, I certainly didn't, I did know then. And that tour was, you know, the old best of times, worst of times, because I was, you know, singing very well. But it, you know, it was difficult to be touring with somebody, you know, that I wasn't going to be married to anymore.
I want to play a song that you were doing then. It's on the Shoot Out the Lights album, but this is a version of it that wasn't on that album. However, it was on an album of yours that came out a few years ago during a period when you weren't singing, and this album collected previously collected takes as well as outtakes and unreleased recordings. So this is an outtake of Walking on a Wire. This is from the early 1980s. Can you tell us what was going through your mind, what your life was like when you recorded this?
Well, as I say, at that time I didn't really know anything was wrong. And Richard, even when we were married, you know, he wrote very bleak songs, you know, bleak lullabies and for the kids and just things that, you know, kind of, I guess, normal songwriters wouldn't do. So the fact that they were, strange songs about life disintegrating, it sounds ridiculous, but I just don't think, although I took on board the emotion of the song and loved to sing it, I didn't really connect it, you know, with myself. As I say, I was expecting a baby and I, you know, everybody that's been pregnant out there will know about pregnancy amnesia, which incidentally never went away for me. I just think you're kind of, you're in, you know, hormone heaven or hormone hell maybe when you're pregnant. And I didn't connect it.
This is Linda Thompson singing the Richard Thompson song, Walking on a Wire.
I wish I could please you. My medicine just won't go right. I'm walking on a wire. I'm walking on a wire. I'm falling. Too many steps to take. Too many spells to break.
That's Linda Thompson, an outtake of the song Walking on a Wire. Richard Thompson on guitar there. It was recorded for an album they did together called Shoot Out the Lights, but this was an outtake that was issued on Linda Thompson's previous CD called Dreams Fly Away, A History of Linda Thompson. She has a new CD now called Fashionably Late. Now, was it on this tour, this Shoot Out the Lights tour, when the marriage was falling apart and you were pregnant, that you... I've read these stories that you kicked Richard in the shins during a performance and smashed all the mirrors in a dressing room backstage.
Yeah, I did.
Was this after you knew the marriage was falling apart? Or
No, it was because I didn't like the mirrors in the dressing room. Yes, no, it was after. Yes, after I knew the marriage was falling apart. Yes, as has oft been documented, I was on the antidepressants, washed down with vodka. So it was a bit of a wild time for me. I was sort of 33 and having a second childhood, sort of scary and liberating at the same time because I'd been very buttoned up.
Had you been inhibited and buttoned up as a kid, or was that like a different way to live for you?
No, I was very, you know, I'm not, you know, I like a lot of musicians and actors, I veer between grand, you know, feelings of grandiosity and feelings of worthlessness. And I think I had that even from a child, you know. But I was always very loud and wild and you know, and happy. You know, I had that sort of good parents and all that sort of stuff. I think I got more, you know, closed down in a way when I was with Richard.
My guests are Linda Thompson and her son Teddy Thompson, who collaborated on her new CD. It's called Fashionably Late. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. With me is Linda Thompson. After being unable to perform for over a decade because of a vocal problem, she's now making a comeback with her new CD, Fashionably Late. Also with us is her son, Teddy Thompson, who collaborated on Linda's new CD. In the 70s and early 80s, Linda performed with her then-husband, singer-songwriter and guitarist Richard Thompson. Their marriage broke up in 1982. There's actually a song that you wrote about Richard Thompson that's on your new CD called Dear Old Man of Mine. I'd like to play the song. Would you say a little bit about it?
Teddy and I went. No, we didn't go. I went to see Teddy and Richard play. Teddy was in Richard's band for a little while, and I just thought Richard was singing particularly well that night. You know, and, you know, like I say in the song, singing like he had a gun to his head. You know, sort of really with a sense of great sort of urgency and. And Teddy said to me, that's a good line. You should work on that. So I did, and then he came up with this wonderful tune,
With the melody.
Teddy
wrote the melody.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, let's hear it. This is Dear Old Man of Mine, and Linda Thompson is singing lead. Teddy Thompson is on guitar, and Linda's daughter Camilla Thompson is singing backup vocals.
Here's to the man that we thought was dead. Singing like he's got a gun to his head. Hanging on sweet notes and a thread. Dear old man of mine. Here's to a father oft times blessed. Here's to the child that he loved best. Does anybody care what happened to the rest? Dear old man of mine.
That's Linda Thompson singing Dear Old Man of Mine from her new CD, Fashionably Late, with her son Teddy Thompson on guitar and daughter Camilla Thompson doing harmony vocals. Teddy Thompson is with us as well as Linda Thompson. Teddy, I'm just thinking, is this awkward for you to be writing the melody to a song that your mother is writing about your father? Yes, exactly. I'm wondering.
The rehashing of my horrendous childhood. That's awkward, yeah. What was the question?
Oh, if it was... As awkward or even more awkward, co-writing the song?
Oh, nah. It's just a job. It's much like cleaning the toilets in McDonald's, writing a tune. It's the same. It wasn't particularly awkward. No, I don't think so.
I feel funny even talking about this with you here, like we're talking about your family history.
Yeah, hello.
Yeah, we're leaving the studio and chucking ourselves under the nearest bus.
But it sounds like everybody's life is in really good shape now. I mean, Richard's been married since the divorce. You've been married since the divorce.
Yeah, that's right.
And
I'm still lonely. It's had a deep effect on my relationship.
But musically, you're in good shape. You've got your own CD. You're on your mother's CD. You're on your father's CD.
Yeah, but am I happy?
Are you happy?
No.
Teddy never gave you a straight answer to anything.
No.
Sorry. Teddy, how did you know all along that you'd be playing music?
Quite early on. Well, I always thought I'd rather like to, but I wasn't. I didn't quite. I mean, until somebody gave me a record deal the first time, I didn't think anybody would be interested.
Were there like family maybe sing-alongs that you?
No. No, there was none of that.
Family fencing matches.
Family shouting matches. No, actually, there wasn't any of that either, really.
No.
You know, I mean, they weren't married. I was 7 when they were divorced. It was a very short period of time when we would have done. And then after that, you know, my mum wasn't singing that much. So it wasn't, music was a big part of our lives. We were all very into music and listening to music, but we didn't play it a lot.
Now that you have a new CD and are singing again, what kind of response are you hearing from old fans who thought they might not ever hear anything new from you again?
Well, the ones I've spoken to, it's been very positive, you know, very positive indeed.
Both of them.
Yes. Sid and Doris Bonkers. it's been, you know, everybody's been fantastic, you know, especially in America. I think people have long memories in America because, you know, the reaction's been fantastic.
Great. Great. Well, congratulations on the new CD.
Thank you so much.
It's really great to hear
much.
You sing again.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Linda Thompson has a new CD called Fashionably Late. Teddy Thompson is featured on guitar and harmony vocals and co-wrote many of the songs. Linda Thompson will tour the States through the month of October. The tour begins on the West Coast with stops in Portland, Vancouver, Seattle, San Francisco, and Los Angeles. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Like an angel sending you love with a crimson smile. You're drowning in kisses and feeding on danger. Not forever, it's just
support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, novelist Jeffrey Eugenides, the author of The Virgin Suicides, has a new book about a contemporary hermaphrodite. It's called Middlesex. Also, Sharon Olds reads from her new collection of poems. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.